welcome to the Bradford Hate Crime Alliance podcast, a series of difficult conversations. Today I'm joined by Heather Wilson. She's the Youth Services Development Manager for Bradford Children and Families Trust, and she'll be talking a little bit about the work she does there, as well as her contributions towards the Knife Angel Project. The Knife Angel came to Bradford in April of 2023. So without further ado, let's hear from Heather. Okay, well, I'm joined today by Heather Wilson from the Bradford Children and Families Trust. She is the Youth Services Development Manager there. Heather, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you here. And if you could just start by just telling us a little bit about your career and how you came to work with Bradford Children and Families Trust.
Yeah, of course I can. Hi, hello everybody. So I'm Heather. So I've worked in Bradford for a long time now. I've worked with children and people a long time. Most of my adult life, really. I've worked with children and young people in different parts of Bradford, so I've sort of been on a bit of a tour around Bradford working in different roles. Started as a part-time youth worker, worked face-to-face with young people in a whole variety of different settings. I've always had a bit of a passion for perhaps the harder to engage children, the children who are a little bit further away from services. Mm-hmm. That's always been a bit of a driver for me, and we've really had opportunity in the last sort of 4 or 5 years to really drive into that agenda and bring other colleagues and other workers with me. So that's been a really exciting sort of development to develop pieces of work that were quite bespoke for some of the children who needed probably more support than they could get through mainstream services, and do some more targeted sort of type of work. So that's where the type of work that we're doing in the trust.
Okay, yeah. In terms of what the impact that has on the young people of Bradford, what are the aims and objectives, and what do you see sort of happening with the initiatives that you are running?
I mean, the piece of work that, you know, is probably most pertinent to this gender is a piece of work called Breaking the Cycle, which is intensive intelligence-led interventions for children who are identified as being at risk of serious organised and violent crime. Yeah. The children who are needing more support, perhaps are being criminally exploited and are not necessarily seeing that exploitation, and it provides one-to-one support for those children in a whole variety and a whole plethora of different settings to try to get alongside those children, young people, understand their lived experience, and really, I suppose, get alongside them to understand what it's like for them, what are some of the drivers into some of that. You know, Bradford's got a massive youth population. We work in the main with children who are over the age of 11, but they're young adults under the age of 24, so it's quite a wide age range that we work with, and our role is as practitioners is very much about, you know, working with that young person to understand what's going on for them, looking at how do we disrupt exploiters who don't have, people who don't have their good interests at heart, giving them the skills to see things for what they are so that they can make more informed choices, you know, and advocating for them so that their voices are heard, you know, if they've had quite difficult backgrounds, if perhaps they've had, you know, childhood experiences that are impacting on them as they grow into adolescence, looking at how do we have an approach that means that we're able to be accessible to them. Sure. But particularly with this piece of work, it's also about working outside of those office hours. It's about being responsive and being about on, you know, the times when those young people need it, whether that's morning, noon, or in the night.
Because people's problems are not sort of a 9-to-5 thing, are they?
That's exactly right.
Unfortunately, a lot of services that do exist tend to exist within those parameters, and it does create such a barrier for people to get the help that they do. Yeah. I was really interested just what you were talking about in terms of working and walking alongside them and really listening and understanding their lived experiences. I mean, that's empathy. And it seems to me that empathy tends to be sort of a forgotten factor in a lot of things nowadays. But actually, people just really want to be heard and believed. And it's such a valuable, transformative tool to be able to employ.
It certainly is. I mean, for a lot of our young people, they struggle with talking, you know, to and opening up to what's going on. They may have family members who, you know, aren't really hearing them or aren't taking them seriously for what they're saying. For some of our children, young people, though, they just choose to keep it to themselves until actually it becomes too much for them to keep to themselves. And we see it presenting in different behaviours, you know, that are playing out. So they may come to attention of police colleagues and, you know, come through the front door of children's social care and places like that, but actually you have to scratch underneath that a little bit and look at what some of those drivers are for some of that you know, for some of the behaviour that you're seeing, and not just take it as being...
There's always reasons.
There always Absolutely. Are reasons, and sometimes you have to work quite hard mm-hmm. to actually get the young person to feel that they can trust you, that they can take, you know, that they can trust to tell you something, and that that's not going to make their life worse.
I agree. It's very easy to kind of polarise somebody whose behaviour does not fit within our societal norms of what we accept and don't accept.
Absolutely.
But you always have to remember, however heinous the crime may be or whatever they have done, there's a reason for that behaviour. There's a reason they've done that. Often abusive and damaging behaviour that they have suffered that has been enacted out in a different way is their way of kind of trying to process that and deal with it. Same thing in terms of hate crime. It's easy to kind of portray the perpetrator as somebody who is just ignorant and just full of hate, but actually where does that come from? Why? Always questioning why.
And I think
what
it is really important
that
you do work with people who are perpetrators as well. You
Absolutely.
Know, we pride ourselves on working with people who are victims, but we also will work with perpetrators, because if we don't do that work, who will? And you can't just say, well, they're a perpetrator, let's put them over there and let's worry about victims only. You can't do that.
No,
you have to work with both sides. And for some of our young people, they are victims who become perpetrators. And, you know, but they're still a victim underneath mm-hmm. that. Mm. And there's a need to really understand that and understand why they are where they are, and then what you can do to help and make that better. Because the whole idea of us being involved is about making things better for those young people.
That's right.
You know, and helping them to see what everybody else around can probably see, but they themselves can't necessarily see. Because a lot of our children and young people, you know, believe the people who are their exploiters are their friends.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
they think they're doing kind things to them, they're giving them things. It's not always they often have an ulterior motive as to why they're doing that.
Yeah, one of the strands of hate crime that we try and highlight and focus on is mate crime.
Yeah.
Specifically targeting the disabled community, unfortunately,
yeah.
where people are taken advantage of through befriending them, where the you know the things that are being done,
yeah.
it's very easy to misinterpret,
and
you end up going
yeah.
down a route where, you know, people's lives can be
and
completely taken
over. And it's very easy
over.
To build trust with people who are also, you know, if they've had very negative experiences, they don't have a good social friendship group, you know, and they're quite isolated in
That's
some
it.
Of that, because part of exploitation, you know, same as hate crime, is that people end up being quite isolated.
Yep.
So it makes them much more vulnerable to people who, you know, do choose to befriend them, but do it for the wrong reasons
exactly.
and don't
to
have their good
advantage.
Interests at heart. Very mm-hmm. definitely, yes.
Yeah. In April of 2023, the Knife Angel came to Bradford.
Yes.
Now,
did.
How did you become involved in that initiative, and what was its impact, sort of having seen that through?
Yeah, I mean, it was very visual when it arrived,
it
wasn't
was.
It? It was certainly quite a sort of shape in the
a
city park,
point,
wasn't it?
Sure.
It was very, very, and it has a real sort of presence there, mm-hmm. really, doesn't he? So, I mean, the Knife Angel was something that Bradford has been trying to get hold of for a little while, really, mm. because he's a created sculpture from weapons that have been seized
yep.
through knife amnesties nationally. And it has then been formed into, you know, there's been a sort of a designer who's designed and formed that the shape of that, and he's a touring piece for an educative purpose,
mm-hmm.
really. So we have worked with colleagues across, you know, services, children, young people, but broader than that as well. So our community safety partnership, our youth justice boards,
yeah.
Our health colleagues, our social care colleagues, you know, the police colleagues. So a big partnership of people who work in Bradford came together to really say, it's okay, the Knife Angel's coming, that's there, and it's great, and it's there, and it's going to do its stuff. But actually what we have to do is try and make sure that we make the most of his presence in the city, and that we use that as an opportunity to get our key messages across about, you know, what does he stand for, what does he depict, that we create those safe spaces for people to have those conversations,
yeah.
that we recognise and acknowledge, you know, people have lost their lives, people have died through injuries created by knife, you know, incidents, and that we created a whole programme as a partnership of, I suppose, awareness raising, education,
mm-hmm.
You know, and also, you know, the piece that I'm talking to you later about, you know, services of remembrance,
yep.
You know, where we acknowledge that this is, you know, for some people this has been life-changing experiences, and it isn't just about don't carry a knife, don't do it, it's a really bad idea, but letting people, helping people to understand why they do it, and for us to understand and work with people to be able to reduce it. So really big education piece, because it actually, whilst he was sat in City Park, there was lots of work going on across all of our city schools, you know, through our Youth Justice Board, doing assemblies, Behind the Blade programmes, with our youth services in our communities, doing sessions within their youth provisions. So it was much more than, you know, what you saw in City Park, you know, and children coming in doing Picassos and drawing him up and putting their you know, we ran an art competition. So a whole plethora of things that were about enabling people to get onto that journey with us, and to start to have conversations about the impact of weapons violence and the impact of that on other people. So it was, you know, it was a really important piece of work. Very well supported by our magistrates. You know, we had Judge Rose working with us on it. So a real plethora of people who were really committed to this agenda. Really successful, as you said. You know, we involved hundreds and hundreds of children and people in it, across the board in different ways, shapes. And there was, I think, you know, for some that success will continue on. You know, if I think now about some piece of work that have fallen out of that, we have some individual young people making mini sculptures at this moment in time, young people who have been victims of crime, who are doing their depiction of violence through a mini sculpture. It's only going to be about 2 foot tall each, but there's probably going to be 8 or 10 of them that are in the pipeline of being created. So those sculptures that those young people are making are giving them a bit of time and a bit of space where we can have those conversations with them about the impact of violence, you know, in their lives. But it's given them also a medium, something to talk over, something to create. You know, we hope that they'll make a mini sort of display piece that will be ready for the next Serious Violence Month, which we're looking to do next year.
Okay.
We did a theatre piece with young people in terms of the impact of County Line activity, where children are trafficked out of the district to sell drugs in trap houses, and the impact of that, and we're doing a part two for that, which is currently being worked up with the theatre group and the young people, ready for next year's Anti-Violence Awareness Month, sort of. So it's all, you know, it has had a bit of a legacy from having the knife angel in the city.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's really important to register and really put that forward, because I think on face value, some people might think it's just sort of performative tick boxing, unfortunately, because it's quite a visual thing, and that the media will just focus on just that without really exploring all the underpinning education, awareness building that actually goes along with that. It's a fantastic symbol. But it sits on top of something that's actually way more valuable and more impactful.
Yeah, and you want that, the legacy of that, to live on in terms of continuing those conversations.
That's right.
You know, it gives permission to start some of those conversations, perhaps in arenas where it's been a bit avoided before. You know, it's wakened people up to the impact and what we have and what we're doing in the city in terms of that, in the district, in terms of the violence agenda. You know, and there's lots more to do.
During that period, at the Cathedral at the Service of Remembrance, you presented a piece of work within that service that we were really keen to capture. So I'm going to hand over the microphone to you now.
Okay.
And I'd like you to just share with us the work that you did.
Yeah, thank you. I'd like to do that. And what I wanted to share really was the details of the piece of work. So one of the pieces of work that we do is that we support children and young people in the accident and emergency department in the local hospital. And the work there was particularly to support young people who are victims of violent incidents, and particularly those where they involve injuries that have had a weapon or a sharp instrument that's caused that injury. So that's where this sort of, if you like, is coming from. And our youth work has been working in there probably about 2 years now. They work every night of the week in there. And it's a really important piece of work because it's easy to say, oh, it's just youth work, it's a bit pastoral care. But it's a really important piece of work for us because what it does do is allow a real lot of support around a young person that can be starting the hospital when they first present, but can continue on then once they've been discharged, and they're, you know, while they either go through treatment or if they don't have any further treatment, to follow up, to continue to support that young person. So this is about a particular night, which had been a really busy night in the hospital. And in one of the rooms at the hospital, there was a real wash of people. There was police and nurses and clinical experts all surrounding the bed of a 14-year-old boy. The youth workers were like the last to the party. They were the last to arrive mm-hmm. to that room because they cover the whole of the department. So they get sort of asked to come across if there's an incident of violence that's come through the door. And over the next few hours, those initial frenzy of activity that was taking place and the assessments and the professionals that were all in that room sort of started to ease. And there was a space then when there was just the young person in the bed, his brother sat outside of him, and the youth workers in the room.
Yeah.
And they sat in silence for a really, really long time, what felt like a really long time. I mean, and in one of the quiet corners of the side room, way away from the business of the hospital, a voice sort of said, you know, that should have been me. Yeah, you know, that should have been me. And the words were barely whispered from the lips of the child who was sitting at the side of the bed. The child whose younger brother was lying in the bed and who, with an injury that had been created by somebody with a weapon. And the child whispered so quietly that anybody who wasn't listening really carefully would have probably missed it. And the youth workers listened and paused and carefully responded, why was that? Why should that have been you? Me and my bro together. He wouldn't have been there if it wasn't for me. My bro, it's my fault. It should have been me. And that dialogue continued with each and every sentence, his words becoming clearer, and the reality and the impact of what had happened earlier that evening suddenly was kicking in and hitting him hard. And sitting at the side of the hospital bed is hard. It's hard for anyone who is having to sit at the side of a bedside, or indeed who's lying in the hospital bed. But it's harder still when you know it could have been prevented and that the incident didn't need to happen. The initial quietly spoken boy who was sat in the corner was gaining volume. He became more animated as the harsh reality of what had happened and who he considered to be to blame for it kicked in. Soon he was consumed by anger, throwing names around and threats. And if they dare do this, if they dare do this to my bro, then well, they're going to get what's coming to them. You see, they don't. And he had a vision that his boys were going to be the ones to sort this out. And from his position, there's so much work to do to support a teenager with angry emotions that are spilling over him, weeping, pacing the room, trying to make sense and understand those emotions, emotions that he hasn't ever felt before, emotions he doesn't know how to control and are consuming him by a mist that disallows clarity and clear thinking. It's so easy, isn't it, to say, don't do it, don't carry, just don't get involved. It isn't very easy when you're living in the moment, under the influence of others, in the fear of others, and under the control of others, to see things for what they really are. The usual clarity of decision-making is blinded by a strength and persuasion of your peers. To be suddenly surrounded by people, no idea who they all are, but they're all here saying they're here to help. But you know, what do they know? They know naught about my life. Those of us outside the scenario try our best to relate. We pass on our knowledge, our assessment of risk, our advice about the negativity of their peer group and our desires to keep them safe. There's so much work to do. That night was a hard emotional experience, emotions he's never felt before, but he's been thrust in a space that's made him stop and think. And for a small moment, there was what you might call a reachable and teachable moment. But I wonder how many reachable and teachable moments have passed him by before we were sitting where we were sitting that night. He tells the youth worker, it's out of control, this. This isn't what was supposed to happen. And we offer reassurance that he wouldn't have intended for this situation to have had this ending. But there's a real disassociation at this point for him between carrying a weapon and the likelihood of injury, or indeed death. The family say, this sort of thing doesn't happen to our boys. Our boys are good boys. Well, let me tell you, it does. And it has. And for this reason, we must double our efforts to work with our young people and our children to identify earlier those who are vulnerable to negative influences and who may drift into these situations when all around them are involved in the use of weapons. There are some lessons in life that we all learn in what you might call the hard school of knock school, and it's so much better if we can learn about it ahead of that knock. We should learn from other people. We know, as a project that works with young people who are trafficked and criminally exploited, coerced and controlled by violence, we know that sometimes, for those children, it's a really scary place to be, where they're encouraged to be prepared for every eventuality, to be prepared for people who aren't going to have your good interests at heart. they're encouraged to protect themselves in some disillusioned way that they're going to be able to protect themselves by what they have stashed up their arm or down the trousers. Unfortunately, this is seldom the case, and the results of this example of this young man in the hospital bed tonight. But it isn't all doom and gloom. It's not all a lost cause. Now more than ever, young people need support and guidance to help them fathom their way in the world. And when they're given the right support and the right guidance, at a time when they're empowered, they turn into empowered young adults. Young adults in our district who are confident and who do not rely on pieces of metal to give them that confidence. Only then will our work be done. Now, we've worked with lots of young people over the years, and that's given us the privilege of seeing and hearing reflections from young people as they start their journey away from weapons and from carrying weapons and knives. And that does give us hope. It gives us hope that young people are prepared to engage with us, although I won't lie, at times it can be really hard work. But it gives us hope that when young people who near the end of their journey with us are in a position to reflect back, to see the coercion, the control and the carrying of weapons and the dangers and potential consequences of carrying, and where they are unable to go forward to make more informed choices. If it wasn't for you, I would be dead. The things you've told me, I never really thought about. The people I love the most in the world, my mum, my dad and even my brothers and sisters, I didn't really think about them. It upsets me now because I saw what happened to my mum. She was crying in the corridor and I could do nothing to help her. I think we're the lucky ones. It might not appear so when one of us is lying in a hospital bed, but we are the lucky ones because it can only get better and we'll both do things differently because of this. In cases of serious violence and the use of weapons, we sometimes forget the breadth of the impact among beyond that of the victim and the perpetrator. The incident is like a stone being thrown into a pond, a ripple that hits many more people, all of whom are impacted by this one single incident. The victim, his siblings, his mother, his father, his wider family, his friends at school and on the street and in the community in which he lives, the wider community in which this incident took place, so many witnesses, tight-lipped witnesses, the police who attended that initial 999 call, the ambulance staff who patched his wounds at the roadside, saving the boy's life as they stemmed his bleed, the little old lady doing her shopping at the corner shop, who was terrified what was playing out before her, the nursing staff, the specialists, the clinical experts, investigating officers, safeguarding teams, and should that injury require ongoing treatment, there would be surgeons, anaesthetists and doctors. The ripple is so far and so wide, it impacts the whole pond in differing waves, but nevertheless, it impacts. And over the months that followed, we commit hours of work to work alongside this young man and his brother. We dedicate a work first to be there for them when they need it, outside of the routine of office hours, to work with him to support finding a more positive peer group, to take part in positive activities, and to be more critical in his thinking and less influenced by people who are his peers. Our boy was lucky. He says now, he's the one that got away. But his realisation is that indeed he really was one of the lucky ones. In moments of reflections, he has the space to see that he has been given another chance, another opportunity to make something of his life. He recently told project evaluators who came to look at some of our work, some of the people who fund our work, he'd no intention to get involved in weapons again, and he was happy to tell others to not be a tool.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. There's so much to unpack. I mean, it's very, very interesting that for these two boys, it really got to the very, very crux of the matter, where the very worst thing happened for them to realise and start to unpack everything that was kind of going on and to be, the self-awareness that's something quite traumatic can kind of engender in people to allow them that space to kind of think and really think about their choices that they're making and the reasons behind
it. And they're not
it.
Always choices that they're making no, from, indeed. You know, they feel sometimes they have no choice. You know, their circumstances are that they're in that position. And we do have to work really hard to identify those children earlier so we can get alongside them earlier. Because the last thing you want is a child in a hospital bed with an injury like that. You want to be able to prevent that if you can, you know, and it's really important that as partners, we remain committed to continuing to work on all the sides of that, you know, that street-based youth work provision, our police colleagues, you know, in terms of identifying children, they're concerned about the children who are coming through the front door of social care and early help services, that we really have to sort of tie some of those things really tightly together to get in as early as we can to prevent our children ending up in our A&E departments. Mm.
And of course, then the wider impact. It's something that we talk a lot about in the hate crime field. It's not just about the victim.
Absolutely.
But it's the victim's families, the victim's friends, the people that identify with that victim if they've been attacked for a particular reason because of who they are, and you also identify with who they are. Yeah. That's going to have the same kind of impact on you.
And there's often a powerlessness in some of
hugely.
That, isn't there? Because you can't help being who you are. Mm-hmm. You are who you are.
Exactly.
And if people don't like who you are, then actually they don't have the right to, you know, assault you, you know, in this way, you know, in this particular case. You know, there is a whole support network needed for people who feel isolated in that way, because it can feel really isolating, you know, and you can find that you know, your own well-being then becomes, you know, very much compromised by that isolation. You know, our minds are cruel things sometimes, you know, and people can be very cruel around people. You know, we're not always as kind as we could be to each other.
No, absolutely.
So helping children to empathise and to see, you know, see difference and celebrate difference and understand difference and not be afraid by difference, you know, are all really important parts of bigger pieces of work you do. It isn't all about just don't carry the weapon. You know, it's about understanding why people feel they need to carry the weapon, why people feel challenged by people who are different to themselves. And very often, they, you know, they haven't had experience, they haven't had opportunity to meet people different to themselves. So some of that earlier facilitation of some of that can be really preventative stuff.
And just the indoctrination that we're all subjected to as part of our upbringing. And I'm always keen on psychology. And if you believe John Bowlby's attachment theory, we're pretty much set by the age of seven.
Yeah.
And everything is set, and your belief systems
are. And that's where we're really lucky in Bradford, also, because having the project Born in Bradford as a very early sort of looking at our very early childhood and looking at children from the age of, you know, from their being born, we've got a lot of research in Bradford. We're in a really privileged position there. We should be utilising all of that as best we can. You know, there's lots of initiatives sort of pouring out of that, isn't it, in light of that research, you know, and the children who were part of the first cohort are now adults almost in their own right. They're well on the way to that journey, aren't they? So we've got a lot of important stuff behind us in that project too.
You talked about the fear and as being one of the primary drivers behind people carrying weapons. Fear is often one of the manifesting factors of why people attack other people for who they are, because they're afraid of who they are for whatever those reasons are, whether that's their own indoctrination, whether that's their upbringing, their socialization. Misinformation is a key one. Especially nowadays, it's something that we can't get away from. The only way you can is to learn to think for yourself, and that takes a lot of time, a lot of work on yourself and self-awareness. So what work do you do to really try and address those fears? You know, and it's important to recognise people aren't just out there necessarily carrying knives with the pure intent to hurt people.
Oh, absolutely.
Some do, I'm sure. But
there will be a minority who go
out. But they are a minority.
But
it's important to recognise that.
Yes, it is. And by far, of the cohort of young people that break in the cycle with, where those children are carrying weapons, it is because they feel unsafe. And we need to understand what it is. They won't often say that they're frightened or they're scared or that's why they're carrying a weapon. But you have to work around to try to identify and understand what it is that they feel unsafe about. Is it about where they're walking? Is it about, you know, the people that they're associating with? Is it about particular parts of the city or district that they're going to? Is it within, you know, different environments that they feel? You know, it's that's what I feel this when I'm in this environment, but I'm okay when I'm over here sort of thing. And we do a lot of work in talking. You know, we have to listen and talk to our young people. Bradford has a massive youth population and children population. It's really important that we have everybody talking to our children to help us understand just what is it like for them, where they live, what is their lived experience like, and what are the things that, you know, we may go, oh, you don't need to be silly about that. We don't need to be worried about that. That's not ever going to happen. You know, take their views and their opinions really seriously, and help them to see and rationalise some of the things, you know, whether they're perceived or real. You know, there's a duty to actually unpack some of that and help young people to see things for what they really are. And sometimes it's okay to be scared, it's okay to feel, that's a perfectly natural human reaction, isn't it, to feel scared and feel frightened by something. You know, we all have moments where we feel frightened by something, but what we have to do is try and look at other ways of coping with that and the ways that you can respond to that emotion of feeling frightened, which doesn't involve taking up a weapon or lashing out and hitting somebody or persecuting somebody in a hate crime or something. So it's about finding the other opportunities and the safe spaces to have some of those conversations, because sometimes it's about, we don't necessarily always facilitate and give people the opportunity to say things that might be a little bit controversial, might be a little bit out of the box and may be frowned on by others about, you can't say things like that. If you don't create those safe spaces to have those conversations, then actually you're never going to get anywhere with some of those people.
You're not, because it's exactly the same thing. We've talked about this in the work that we do. You know, the people that have those views, if what we might perceive to be racist views, again, they're manifested by something. Something has happened. There is some form of belief system that underpins that. And in order to be able to gently challenge it and dig deeper and to try and find out what are the drivers for that particular belief system to be held, you have to allow them to say what it is that they believe, what their perception is. They have to have that voice. Otherwise, if you're just going to shut them down and go, no, that's wrong, we don't accept that, you're just pushing them further into their corner.
Absolutely. And it's really important we bring them out. We have those difficult, challenging at times discussions.
Really difficult.
But it isn't just a case of I'm right and you're wrong. It's helping them see and make more informed choices by giving them that range of things about. And also allowing them to the space sometimes to put themselves into the shoes of the other people and how it might be for other people, so they start to see it and experience it. And how do you think that'll feel? You know, when we talk about work with individual young people, you know, about how do you think that's going to make your mum feel? How do you think that's going to make you know your great auntie Maud feel? How do you think that's going to make your brother feel? And actually sometimes they actually haven't allowed themselves that space to touch that emotional sort of warmth to that, and sometimes there's a big sort of barrier up where actually they don't really care about what that makes people feel, because they aren't in that space where they've got to, and you have to create that space to allow them to process that and start to come to walk in somebody else's shoes to see it from a different perspective. And sometimes that's a real long way from where they're at in terms of their viewpoint. And there isn't a magic wand. It doesn't happen overnight.
No,
you have to work with that, and you have to help them find examples where you can say, do you see that? Might that have felt like that? Do you see the similarities between that and this? And help them sort of put that into context, really.
And a willingness to engage in that process in the first place.
And the dialogue is really important.
Hugely.
To us all.
And the safe space, as you say, you've got to be able to hold space so that they don't feel threatened, that they're going to be castigated for whatever it is that they truly believe.
And in places like youth provisions, you want to have some of those discussions, but you don't want to ostracise people who have got a particular viewpoint. You know, you have to bring them in and work with around that, and so that people feel safe there, you know, wherever they're coming from.
Because I mean, essentially what we're talking about is education, and I know that was certainly one of the key drivers underpinning the Knife Angel project. And it's certainly some of the key work that we do, and we see the importance and value of it in terms of hate crime. Reporting is key. It's vital.
It is.
But it's the firefighting end of it. Actually, the solution, the problem solving has to come from the education. It has to, you know, from a really early age.
Absolutely.
To build that awareness.
And it's also an awareness and a confidence in being able to say something. The opportunities there are for people to report, you know, you can, if people are not feeling confident about actually standing up and saying, actually, this is what's happening, there are lots of ways that people can do that anonymously. But we do need to know what's going on, because that's the only way that we can help people, to protect people, to help people feel more supported and to feel they're less isolated, less alone in the world in that particular set of circumstances.
Yeah, that's it. But there's so much shame attached to when you are attacked for being who you are. That can engender an awful lot of shame, which is a huge silencer, and it just pushes people further and further away.
And it also has that massive impact on people's other well-being, doesn't it? It's not, you know, it's not just it's their mental well-being, it's their emotional well-being, you know, which reduces people wanting to go out and be part of the community, and they avoid things. So there's a whole massive ripple out of
hugely in
that pond, if you like, of the impact from what can sometimes be just a single incident, actually.
And in terms of working, moving forward, just to sort of finish off, where do you see the work that you're doing now growing to, enhancing, and what would you like to achieve?
Oh golly, we've got so much more work to do, haven't we? I mean, we need to do more of what we're already doing. Mm. There's definitely a need for much more of that work. We work really closely with our education providers. We want to get into more of our schools, and you'll have youth workers in schools from our local authority youth workers and things. You know, we need to drive into those arenas where young people are.
That's right.
Earlier, mm. the better. You know, if we can get into that early help arena, develop more of that. And for people to feel empowered and safe, really, about, you know, whether we'll ever get to the point where everybody always feels safe. But we need more people to feel safe than they currently do, and we need more people to understand who are the people they can talk to safely, mm. who are not going to cause them harm, who are going to help them, protect them, you know, and work with them to find solutions to what sometimes can feel like really sticky situations sure. for them to be in. Yeah. I don't know, I don't see an end result where I'll go, that's it, our work is done here.
We are a work in progress on all fronts, right?
On all fronts, absolutely. Yeah. But plenty to keep us busy and occupied, I think, and a real willingness mm-hmm. for people to work together to achieve, you know, better things.
And looking at those horizons ahead, and obviously this is as you said, mm. long-term work, mm. But recognising that these solutions are possible.
Oh, 100%.
That things can be made better.
Yes.
Can be improved. But it takes everybody to get on board.
Yes, it does.
And we need to get away from this notion that certain things like knife crime, oh, that's a problem in that postcode or mm-hmm. that part of the country, or hate crime, well, that happens to that community, mm-hmm. that's not who I identify with. Mm-hmm. We're all kind of responsible. Yeah, yeah. If something impacts on society as a whole, absolutely. As a member of society, yeah. we have to kind of take collective ownership of
yeah.
repairing the problem.
Yeah, working towards mm-hmm. the solutions together with the people who yeah. are being impacted by it. Yeah, really important stuff.
Yeah. Well, Heather, it's just been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with all your work in the future.
Thank you very much.
Well, we'd like to thank Heather for joining us today. I'm sure you'll agree they are doing some fantastic work with these young people. If you're a victim of hate crime or you witness it, please do report it. That's so important. You can do that in various different ways. You can log on to our website, www.bradfordhatecrimealliance.com, and report straight onto there. If you'd like to download our mobile reporting app, you can do so by going to listenbradford.com and downloading the app. That's also available via our website. You can email us at information@bradfordhatecrimealliance.org.uk. Or you can call us on 0800 169 1664. That's 0800 169 1664. Until next time, take care.